I wanted to talk about the impact of Darwinism on the concept of the human soul and carrying it a little bit up to the present. In 1859, within a week of receiving a pre-publication copy of his former student's bold new book on the origin of species, the great 19th century Cambridge University geologist Adam Sedgwick wrote to Charles Darwin. This is before the book came out, by a week. "I have read your book with more pain than pleasure. 'Tis the crown and glory of organic science that it does, through final cause, link material to moral. You have ignored this link. And if I do not mistake your meaning, you have done your best in one of two pregnant cases to break it. Were it possible, which thank God it is not, to break it, humanity in my mind would suffer a damage that might brutalize it." Well, that's an interesting letter to get from your former teacher, person you used to, who taught you geology and you used to go geologizing with, who had been president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science and one of the lions of British science. It's an interesting letter to get on the eve of the publication of your great work. And those are the points he's trying to stress. "I've read your book with more pain than pleasure." Okay. And then he's saying it's the crown and glory of organic science. So he's talking about biology, that it does through final cause, I guess think back to Aristotle, link material to moral. Well, that's the issue. It doesn't say anything about common descent. That's not an issue. This is the issue that Adam Sedgwick decides to home in on. The Origin of Species, of course, is the book that Darwin used to launch publicly his theory of evolution by natural selection, itself a product of over two decades of painstaking, largely private research, which, in turn, followed in the wake of Darwin's famous four-year voyage around the world as a young naturalist aboard the British survey ship HMS Beagle. It was during that voyage that Darwin first took seriously the idea that current plant and animal species may have evolved from pre-existing species rather than been specially created by God. As an idea, evolution was as old as science itself, but had never gained widespread acceptance among scientists, at least until Darwin's day. Known but not yet expected. This, of course, is what Darwin looked like when he went on the voyage of the Beagle. Now, we already see how Adam Sedgwick, one of the greatest scientists of England, responded to his pre-publication issue of the book. Common descent, not an issue that he raised, focusing in on this. Get one other person out. Now, Darwin sent only a few pre-publication books out. Another one went to this man, Asa Gray, probably the greatest botanist, maybe the greatest biologist in North America. Harvard University botanist Asa Gray, whose work, of course, in the botany of this area was legendary. I mean, this was one of the important areas that he covered, this area and the Pacific coast. Now, when Asa Gray received his pre-publication, his advanced copy of The Origin of Species, he wrote back. He also expressed concerns about the book's theological implications. His reply to Darwin, of course, took longer to get back because he had to send it over to the United States and send it back. And when Darwin got his reply, this is how Darwin responded to Asa Gray's letter, who raised concerns about the theological, the moral implications, questions just about like Adam Sedgwick raised. He said, "I had no intention to write atheistically," Darwin replied to Gray, "but I own that I cannot see, as plainly as I do, evidence of design and beneficence on all sides of us. There seems to be too much misery in the world. I cannot persuade myself that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichthyomoniae with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars. or the cat should play with the mouse before killing it. Alluding to William Paley's analogy between a crafted watch and the human eye, which the Anglican theologian's famous proof of intelligent design behind organic creation, and I guess importantly, behind us, Darwin then added in his letter to Gray, "Not believing this, I see no necessity in the belief that the eye was expressly designed," end quote. Even human nature and mental ability, he writes, might result from natural processes. Well, the sequence in Darwin's letter to Gray is telling. He passed quickly from observations of what seemed bad in nature, such as cruel animal behavior, which most people hesitate to blame on God, to their implications for what seemed good in nature, such as the human eye, which Victorians typically credited to God, and then moved on to ponder the origins of what seemed best of all, human morality and mentality, which Victorian-era natural theologians typically hailed as the ultimate gift and proof of the divine supernatural. In Origins of Species, Darwin avoided making comment about human evolution, fearing that they would prejudice readers against his general, larger theory of common descent. But in his private notes, essays, and letters reveal a long-standing fascination with just those precise issues. Indeed, those were what most interested him in evolution, not the simple concept of common descent. Indeed, Darwin's earliest private notebooks on evolution are peppered with comparisons between the strikingly primitive people of Tierra del Fuego, whom he met on his Beagle voyage, and pampered primates in the London Zoo. Here's one of the drawings from one of his works. Darwin wrote in 1838, that's immediately after his conversion to evolution theory, and over 20 years before he published Origin of Species. "Let man visit orangutan in domestication, hear expressive whine, see intelligent, then let man dare to boast of his proud preeminence." Here Darwin inserted the phrase, quote, these are notes, "not understanding the language of the Fuegians puts them on a par with monkeys." In a later entry, Darwin demanded, "compare the Fuegians and orangutanian, and dare to say difference so great." Darwin frequently speculated about animal origins of human traits, such as when he wrote in 1839, we're all talking about the year or two after he converts to the theory, and fully 2 decades before he published An Origin of Species. Let me quote again. "One's tendency to kiss, almost to bite, that which one sexually loves is probably due to our direct ancestors having been like dogs to bitches. As for the vaunted, quote, mind of man," Darwin concluded, "it is no more perfect than instincts in animals. Human thought itself, like animal instincts, he attributed to brain structure, chiding himself, quote, right in his notebook, oh, you materialist, for the thought. Continually he probed in his private writings the perceived boundary questions." Again, quoting, "does a negress blush? I am almost sure that Fuegians did," he asked himself at one point early on. "Animals, I should think, would not." Thinking, what's the difference between humans and animals? Well, while Darwin avoided publicly commenting on human evolution, his most visible scientific supporter in England, the well-connected British comparative anatomist T.H. Huxley, pictured in this picture, took up the cause and made it his own. So Darwin was thinking about all the connections, but he didn't talk about them publicly. Huxley, of course, did. In 1863, 3 years after publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species, Huxley packaged the pieces of his previous arguments on the topic into a single popular book, Evidence of Man's Place in Nature.
Quote, "Whatever system of organs be studied," Huxley concluded, "the structural differences that separate man from the gorilla and the chimpanzee are not so great as those which separate the gorilla from the lower apes." And this is his famous picture, putting together the skeletons. The most vexing question raised by Darwinism concerned the origins of human mental and moral attributes, particularly altruistic behavior and sacrificial love. Could those distinguishing human characteristics have evolved by the naturalistic process? This is the question that the Victorian evolutionist asks. Or did God implant them in an evolved human body? Could selfish struggle for survival processes produce self-sacrificing humans? Now, traditionally, Christian theologians had attributed these attributes to an indwelling soul, the existence of which lifted humans above other animals. Scientists generally segregated humans from other animals on this basis as well. From Aristotle's theory of the rational soul followed only in humans, through the Cartesian dualism splitting physical matter from the human and divine soul, to Georges Cuvier's division of humans and primates into separate taxonomic orders. Now Huxley, in Man's Place in Nature, lumped humans in the same order with other primates and boldly asked, quote, "Is the philanthropist or the saint to give up his endeavors to lead a noble life because the simplest study of man's nature reveals at its foundations all the selfish passions and fierce appetites of the meanest quadruped? Is mother love vile because a hen shows it? Or faithfulness base because dogs possess it?" These became the new questions of the Darwinian age. Again, it wasn't common descent. It was these questions. Well, see Darwin a little older, time of publication of The Origin of Species. After steering clear of the intense public debate over human evolution for over a decade, and we're not talking about the body's evolution, we're talking about the whole bit of the evolution of fully human beings, in 1871, Darwin finally broke his public silence on the subject in the book Descent of Man. "The sole object of this work," he wrote, "is to consider firstly whether man, like every other species, is descended from some pre-existing form, secondly, the manner of his development, and thirdly, the value of the difference between the so-called races of man." In this book, Darwin raised the key issues that would ever after occupy researchers in the field. Now, Darwin's basic case for human evolution consisted of two parts. First, he presented the by then well-known evidence for the evolution of the human body in its anatomy and embryonic developments. "People resemble other animals," he noted, "and the persistence of monkey rudimentary organs and features, such as a tailbone, for example, I suppose, reinforced the conclusion that the human body evolved from lower forms. Relying primarily on structural similarities, Darwin traced human ancestry from," and I'm quoting from him, "from the most ancient origins in the vertebrate kingdom through ancient fishes and amphibians, early marsupials, to," quote, "the new world and old world monkeys, and from the later to, at the remote past, to man, the wonder and glory of the universe," end quote. Well, the body's evolution, though, even if accepted, did not settle the matter because many believed that humans stood apart from animals not because of their bodies, but due to their minds and emotions. Darwin thus extended, in the book Descent of Man, his naturalistic analysis to include those mental and moral attributes that supposedly uplifted humanity, such as higher reasoning, self-consciousness, religious devotion, and the ability to love. Those were the ones that would be typically cited in the Victorian period in this debate over the meaning of evolution for humanity. "The mental powers and moral feelings of humans differed in degree rather than in kind from those of animals," Darwin asserted, "with a progressive gradient linking the lowest beasts to the highest humans." Here's a picture from his book. drawing a very human-like ape, I suppose. Darwin highlighted the human-like qualities of higher animals, particularly pet dogs and wild primates, and the ape-like and the animal-like qualities of the low savages. Quote, "Can we feel sure that an old dog with an excellent memory never reflects on his past pleasures in the chase? And wouldn't this be a form of self-consciousness?" he wrote in a typical passage. "On the other hand, how little can the hard-working wife of a degraded Australian savage reflect on the nature of her own existence?" Exclamation point. Similarly, Darwin doubted whether Fuegians felt religious devotion, yet saw, open quote, again I'm quoting, "some distinct approach to this state of mind in the deep love of a dog for his master." While Darwin attributed the evolution of even the most ennobling of human traits to the same gradual, naturalistic survival of the fittest process that he envisioned as producing all living things, here was his theory of evolution by natural selection applied to human nature. "Long ago in Africa," he suggested, "some anthropodal apes descended from the trees, started walking erect in open spaces, began using their hands to hold and to hunt, and developed their brains, all in incremental steps that helped to preserve the individual or its group. As in Origin of Species, the variations themselves were either inborn or acquired, with beneficial ones propagated through natural selection. Darwin envisioned the winnowing process at work among individuals, nationalities, races, and civilizations, and as he put it in his own Victorian way, with hard-driving, hard-working Englishmen and their American, I'm sure including Canadian, offspring advancing to the fore. He knew his audience. Yet for all the power that Darwin attributed to natural selection in molding humanity and guiding advance, he saw the process as incapable of generating gender and external racial differences. Here was, just to bring it up, this is a classic example of the from the day of the primate species moving into humans. Now, he didn't, again, gender and external racial differences, those he couldn't see how evolution would produce. For these, Darwin resorted to and elaborated on the secondary process of sexual selection that he had introduced in Origin of Species to account for the evolution of male mating traits, such as the peacock's tail, which he didn't see had direct survival benefit. "People differ in what they find attractive in mates," Darwin explained in Descent of Man. Again, quoting from, "Africans prefer dark skin and depressed noses, while Europeans favor light skin and straight noses," he asserted. "While," again I'm quoting, "while in Java, a yellow, not a white girl, is considered a beauty." Within each race, Darwin speculated, sexual selection propagates an exaggerated favored external characteristics as the most attractive mates are chosen first and have the most children. For instance, he suggested that Hottentot women have large bottoms because tribesmen desire to display that trait. "Gender differences arise in a similar fashion," Darwin added, quote, "as the strongest and most vigorous men have been able to select the more attractive women, and together they would have succeeded in rearing a greater average number of offspring. Thanks to sexual selection," Darwin concluded, "men possess greater strength and intellect, while women display more beauty and tenderness. Nature made snow." Well, now, here is an argument rooted in its time and place, Victorian England. Now, Descent of Man offered the first comprehensive, naturalistic theory of human evolution, but it didn't, and this is important, it didn't change many minds. Europeans and Americans had hotly debated the proposition that humans evolved beasts ever since the publication of Origin of Species in 1859. But most continued to reject the idea long after the appearance of Descent of Man in 1871, including many evolutionists within Darwin's inner circle. Now, I'm not suggesting they didn't accept evolution. They did accept evolution. The idea of common descent was very quickly and widely accepted among educated Americans, British people, Europe, Canada, scientific community. What they didn't buy was the evolution that the Darwinian process could produce these higher human characteristics. An example of this would be from Alfred Russel Wallace, who co-discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection along with Darwin, and who remained a staunch Darwinist on other matters. He became convinced that, as he called it, an overruling intelligence created the first humans by ennobling anthropological apes with enlightened minds. Quote, natural selection could only have endowed the savage with a brain a little superior to that of an ape, Wallace wrote in 1869 and maintained ever after, again quoting, whereas he actually possessed one but very little inferior to that of the average member of our current learned societies. So much for the savages. You notice the different presentations of the savages, so-called savages. And that was a phrase they'd both use. Darwin, in his works, constantly lowered them and presented the Australia and Native Australians and the Fuegians, who were always his lowest example, as very little different than apes. Where Wallace, who had lived with them and spent extensive time, constantly would always present them, as he put it right here, very little different than that of the average member of our race. Very different view from the two founders of Darwinism, I suppose I could say. Now, Darwin's mentor and friend, the geologist Charles Lyell, there is no person more important for Darwin's discovery of evolution than the work of Charles Lyell. Very close friend, one of his mentors. He, when it came out, promptly endorsed Wallace's position, much to Darwin's dismay. For his part, Asa Gray, whose picture we've all saw, and is also one of the closest confidants of Darwin, steadfastly maintained that God supervised the beneficial variations that produced distinctly human beings. Darwin's view of human origins received even less support from non-scientists. And I could go on with the world of science. Lord Kelvin, James Clerk Maxwell, these were people consistently standing out, often agreeing with Darwin about evolution, common descent, disagreeing on this issue. Well, it was even stronger among non-scientists. The triumph of evolutionism, the Victorian scientific community during the 1860s, did not translate to widespread popular acceptance of the theory, especially with respect to human origins. Science did not then dominate how Europeans and Americans viewed the natural world, much less the supernatural. The matter of human origins was particularly sensitive because it impacted how people viewed themselves, other persons, and God. Crucially, evolutionary naturalism undermined belief in an indwelling spiritual as opposed to material soul, which for many people defined the very essence of humanness. The doctrine that God specially created the first people by giving them eternal, non-material souls carried with it certain implications about the meaning of human life. The theory that humans evolved by purely naturalistic means from soulless animals carried others. And many individuals found it very difficult to switch, much more difficult than switching on whether species had a common ancestry for their bodies. People didn't have near very much problem back then with that issue. It's this issue that caused the problems. Dropping to the conventional level, an 1871 cartoon in the British magazine Punch captures the tension. And I'll show it to you. I don't know if you can quite read it, but it's one of my favorites. It shows, as you can see here, an earnest young husband in a very, very family scene reading to his wife and child in front of a fire. But if you get closer, what he's reading from is, this is 1871, he's reading from Darwin's just published book, The Descent of Man. And the caption reads, "So you see, Mary, baby is descended from a hairy quadruped with pointed ears and a tail. We all are," he explained. His wife countered, "Speak for yourself, Jack. I'm not descended from anything of the kind, I beg to say, and baby takes after me." This captured the general mood. back on to Wallace at that time. Late in his life, Wallace could claim, with some hyperbole, but not all that much, Wallace writing, that, quote, all of the greatest writers and thinkers agreed that the higher mental and spiritual nature of man is not the mere animal nature advanced through survival of the fittest. He lived until what, 1913? This would have been about at the turn of the century. Novelist Leo Tolstoy proclaimed this viewpoint in Russia, for example. The prominent congregational cleric Henry Ward Beecher did so in the United States. In Canada, I suppose it's most conventionally associated with the famed McGill geologist William Dawson, who was probably the country's premier scientist at the time and president of the American Association of Advancement of Science. All of these embraced evolutionism to a point, but maintained that only God could make a soul. The Roman Catholic Church doctrine gradually and fitfully moved toward accepting this position. During the late 1800s, British Prime Minister William Gladstone made a point of endorsing the divine creation of the human soul. Whether expressed in scientific commentary or editorial cartoons, the basic sentiment was similar. Most people simply refused to believe their highly developed minds, morals, and emotions could evolve from those of beasts. The gap appeared too great. They felt themselves superior to animals. For many, these feelings carried more weight than any abstract scientific hypothesis. Those sentiments were captured in an 1872 editorial cartoon appearing in the Chic London Literary Journal and published soon after Darwin's two principal books on human evolution. It wasn't just Descent of Man. He brought out Descent of Man, and then right after it, he brought out the book Expressions of Emotions in Man and Animals, other big book of the time. Now let me get the cartoon up here. The cartoon features, remember the name of the book, Expressions of Emotions in Man and Animals and Descent of Man. And the cartoon features a stylish woman scolding, as you can see, a tailed, apish-looking Darwin. Quote, really, Mr. Darwin, say what you like about the descent of men, but I wish you would leave my emotions alone. Just as some people instinctively rejected the idea of human evolution, others, including the evolution and naturalistic production of the human soul, others embraced that concept for reasons that had little to do with science. Materialists, atheists, and radical secularists had long displayed a certain fondness for evolutionary theory of origins, such as those of the French Enlightenment naturalist, the Chevalier de Lamarck, anything to dispense with God. Even though Darwin held strictly conventional political and economic views, his theory attracted the usual crowd on that basis. Huxley and the influential German biologist Ernst Haeckel initially embraced Darwinism in part because it supported their anti-clerical agendas for science and society. Ernst Haeckel, in particular, carries it even further because he's the founder of the Monist League, which you might have heard of, in Germany, and that was the whole point of the Monist League, to get rid of anything spiritual. There's singularity of material and moral, as it were, and the Monist League has its own particular nefarious history, leading into World War I and then indirectly on beyond that. Karl Marx saw in Darwinism a scientific basis for his envision of class struggle. In 1873, he sent Darwin a copy of Das Kapital, inscribed with the word, to Mr. Darwin, on the part of his sincere admirer, Karl Marx. An avowed capitalist and very proud capitalist, Darwin acknowledged the gift cordially in a note, but never opened the book. To this day, it remains in Darwin's library with the pages uncut, so we know he never opened it. In the United States, feminist leader Elizabeth Cady Stanton welcomed Darwinism as a means to undermine what she saw as a biblically based arguments for the subordination of women. Open quotes. The real difficulty in women's case is that the whole foundation of the Christian religion rests on her temptation and fall, she wrote in something called the Women's Bible. If, however, we accept the Darwinian theory that the race has been gradually grown from lower to higher forms of life, and the story of the fall is a myth. We can exonerate the snake, emancipate the women, and reconstruct a more rational religion for the 19th century. Well, that's from the left. From the right wing of the political spectrum, the enormously influential mid-19th century English social philosopher Herbert Spencer, already an evolutionist, freely worked Darwinian materialism into his progressivist philosophy of social development, which was dubbed social Darwinism by its critics. Who do I have here? Haeckel, who I've already mentioned, carried those ideas to the German-speaking world with translated editions of his most popular books, returning back to Britain and English-speaking North America to reinforce social Darwinism in his home. This is an example from Darwin, from his History of the World, a very popular book showing the evolution of the various human races as he saw it, and where different people fit on the spectrum of things. As social theorists, Spencer, Haeckel, and Darwin became inexorably linked in the public mind during the late 19th century. Spencer's many followers, whose numbers comprised a virtual social registry of Anglo-American moneyed elite, typically embraced Darwinism as well. In his autobiography, for example, the Scottish-American industrialist Andrew Carnegie recalled the day in 1870 that his reading of Darwin's Descent of Man, Haeckel's History of Creation, where this chart comes from, and various books by Spencer transformed his life. I'm quoting from Carnegie. "I remember that light came in." This was his epiphany. He was actually reading Darwin's Descent of Man at the time. "I remember that light came in as a flood, and all was clear. Not only had I got rid of theology and the supernatural, but I had found the truth of evolution. Man was not created with an instinct for his own degradation, but the lower had risen to the higher forms." And here we have Haeckel's Tree of Life with humans right at the top. For people like Carnegie, Darwinism became a religion, or an alternative to religion. Pictorially, this sentiment was captured in a popular 1883 poster attributed to the London secularist George Holyoake, which purported to illustrate the fragmentation of the established British national church into various factions ranging from high church and Roman Catholicism to dissent and rationalism. Now, the picture is a huge poster, and it covers, but you see right up in the part, actually, that's just one quadrant of it. You see the dome of St. Paul's, which is turned into an umbrella, typically. And if you go in the other direction, you'll see Anglo-Catholics going off in one direction, and Catholics breaking off in another direction, and low church breaking off in a different direction, all with pictures and names. But up in the upper left-hand corner, under the banner of Darwinism, you'll see an ape leading Spencer, Huxley, and other agnostics away from the central umbrella-like dome toward a distant cloud of protoplasm. Let me make that a little bigger. Just that one part. A bust of Darwin rises above the clouds. With his giant white, with his great white beard, Darwin could as readily appear as godlike or as apish. Depends on how you wanted to draw him. We saw both illustrations. And during the late 19th century, illustrators often pictured him in both godlike or apish-like pictures. It had less to do with science than with society. Well, this was the division that pulled apart late Victorian era over this issue that Darwin raised. And in some ways, very little has changed over the past century. Many otherwise committed evolutionists draw the line on materialism when it comes to the ascent of man. Just a typical example, and I could give dozens and dozens. The noted Oxford University ornithologist, David Lack. Here's his picture. And I pick him because his groundbreaking work in the 1947 book on study of Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands literally gave wing to the modern neo-Darwinian synthesis. There wasn't any field study that was more important to resurrecting and giving international credibility to the neo-Darwinian synthesis. Nevertheless, the same man who is the core, one of the core people involved in the neo-Darwinian synthesis, said of the higher attributes of humans, and I quote, "Science has not accounted for morality, truth, beauty, individual responsibility, or self-awareness. And many people hold that from its nature, it can never do so." Just picking an example from today, the noted American geneticist, Francis Collins, who heads the Human Genome Project in America and is known for finding the cystic fibrosis gene, among others, wrote in the year 2002, "Science will certainly not shed any light on what it means to love someone, what it means to have a spiritual dimension to our existence, nor will it tell us much about the character of God." Well, opinion surveys suggest that Collins speaks for about 40% of the American people and up to a like percentage of American sciences when he posits God as somehow involved in the evolutionary process, at least to the extent of breathing a supernaturally created soul into a naturally evolved body. For the record, the Roman Catholic Church approves this position. Quote, "Rather than the theory of evolution, we should speak of several theories of evolution, materialistic, reductionist, and spiritual," Pope John Paul II declared in that famous 1996 message to the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. He went on to say, "The theories of evolution, which in accordance with the philosophies inspiring them, considering the mind as emerging from the focus, from the forces of living matter, or as mere epiphenomena of this matter, are incompatible with the truth about man." In some ways, this echoes the speculations of Jesuit scientist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, which attracted considerable attention a half century ago, and the thoughts of a long line of mainline and even some conservative Protestant theologians over the past century. I suppose it was captured in this famous cartoon from the New Yorker that many of you have probably seen. These percentages mask a fundamental split between science and society, however. While roughly a similar share of both the general public and the scientific community admit at least some element of theism into their thinking on human evolution, 4 in 10 by virtually every poll, their other halves, or more precisely, I guess, their other 6/10, differ sharply. Among people in the United States, and polls that have covered Canada tend to come out somewhat similarly, on average, about 5 out of the remaining 6 fundamentally reject the concept that humans evolved from lower animals, while by like margins, most American scientists dismiss any role for God in evolution, even in the case of man. Like Darwin, many of them see human mental and moral attributes, including altruistic behavior and belief in God, as the product of natural forces, or as British science writer Richard Dawkins likes to put it, quote, "the blind watchmaker." Dawkins' books have become bestsellers in Britain, the United States, and Canada, and his vision of human evolution, or more precisely, the vision that he has popularized from the work of such preeminent late 20th century biologists as William Hamilton and E.O. Wilson, and this is a picture of all three of them lined up, Dawkins in the middle and Hamilton and Ed Wilson, is shared by many evolutionary biologists today. Humans, like all living organisms, quoting here from Dawkins, are survival machines, robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. The genes themselves cannot plan ahead or respond to their environment, he stresses. They simply reproduce themselves with occasional random mutations that may or may not assist their survival, and we are the astonishing, or should I say astonished, result. Dawkins finds this view of life exhilarating. For him, it frees humans from the burden of purposeful design in nature, which he identifies, and I'm quoting again, as the most influential of the arguments for the existence of God. Unlike the controlling purposes of a designing God, Dawkins exalts natural selection, the blind, unconscious, and these are his words, automatic processes which Darwin described and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and apparent purposeful form of all life. These have no purpose in mind. Well, from the very outset, and here's Ed Wilson, and let's see, do I have one more? Yes. From the very outset, what people found most exciting or frightening about Darwinism was the prospect that humans evolved from beasts by a naturalistic process that went back in some material cause and effect chain to earliest forms of life. And that's what this picture captures, this picture in Punch. This shows the lion of the season. This was from the year that T.H. Huxley published his book, Man's Descent, where Man's Place in Nature. And that ape is, of course, supposed to be Huxley, drawing, if you back then you'd recognize that as Huxley, being introduced at a proper English social function, with the person introducing him says, Mr. Gorilla, that is, the ape walking into proper British society. Now, Dawkins now expresses this view that was the shocking view in that Victorian picture in starkly dramatic terms, but except for the bit about genes, which were unknown in the 19th century, he does not claim to say anything more than Darwin said in Descent of Man, or, for that matter, indirectly in Origin of Species. I open my talk today by quoting from Adam Sedgwick's wistful 1859 response to Darwin's Origins book, that letter he wrote. Although Sedgwick closed his letter with a lighthearted reference to himself, quote, as a son of a monkey, neither in that letter nor in his other voluminous writings did he ever give one inch on the divine source of the human soul. This was fundamental to Sedgwick's faith and to his science. For him and most other Victorians, as for so many today, including any number of evolutionists, that was and is no laughing matter. The human soul remains at the heart of the ongoing debate over human origins. Well, that's my introduction to the background to this issue, the human soul in the Victorian period, and I'd love to open it to questions.
Let me just identify yourself.
Lauren Wilkinson from college.
Hello, Lauren. I've met you before.
I wonder if has there been in this history much recognition of the fact that this description of the soul as a supernatural emplacement in perhaps a natural body is not really a biblical view. And in fact, this picture of the soul as something inhabiting the body is not really a biblical view. And that the more biblically Christian position is that we are perhaps destined for the gift of eternal life, not through the survival of the soul, but through the resurrection of the body. And that the Christian position isn't really even committed to the idea of a supernatural soul and a natural body, but a result of the obvious juxtaposition of the growth of Christianity in a Greek culture. Has this been a part of the discussion at all? Because it seems like your presentation almost assumes the idea of a separation of soul and body, an immortal soul and a natural body, as though Christianity is committed to the idea of a
the immortality of the soul, which is not a biblical doctrine, rather the resurrection of the body, much more unitary holistic view.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a fascinating point. Not surprised, coming from you, that it would raise a fascinating point. And it fits in very interestingly with what people were discussing. People wanted to view themselves as special. And there was this long tradition of the idea of a human soul. And that's where people were drawing the line. Now, you're right, it doesn't necessarily have Christian roots. And think of Wallace, who was the most visible proponent of it, was not a Christian. He would be, you'd probably describe him as some sort of a New Age spiritualist. If you tried to apply him to something today, he'd be some sort of a New Age spiritualist, deeply impressed with the spiritual beliefs of the peoples that he found around the world. He was drawing on that. And you look at the Catholic Church, which was digging its heels on the soul element, going back through St. Augustine and others, and I think they were drawing, I think you're precise, on the Greek traditions. They were looking at Aristotle, who talked about the rational soul that made humans different. They're going back through Descartes, who had this humans and God, the human soul and God were on one side of the great Cartesian dualism, and everything else was on the other side. And so they were drawing the line on the issues that, well, you couldn't produce, and the four things I mentioned, if I can remember them all, that's why I wrote them down so I remember, but basically altruistic love being the most important, altruistic love and belief in God. And remember, that fits right into Descartes' proof for the existence of God, the concept that we can think about it. It ties a little bit into Thomas Aquinas. So these people were thinking, St. Jean Minervet in England was talking about these issues, an important biologist, the Duke of Argyll was talking about these issues. And they were raising those differences, which were very different than the types of issues that you think can develop. That was a way they could concede the evolution of the human body. But of course, you're right, they could have taken it an entirely different route, the route you're suggesting, and say that it isn't the human soul, and it shouldn't matter necessarily whether the human body has evolved, as long as God was somehow involved in the initial conception, that the human body evolved from other animals, to have the human body have a bodily resurrection. But no, it's interestingly, they didn't seem to care at all. It wasn't the body, the resurrection of the body, that seemed to matter. And then you can go to a lot of, you'd almost call them proto-fundamentalists, very important theologians, B.B. Warfield, theologians at Princeton, theologians at Rochester Theological Seminary, American theologians who would have been certainly described themselves as evangelicals. Who accepted evolution, or at least said, we don't know if evolution's true because it was still in debate, but we don't have any problem. If evolution's proved to be true, evolution of the body, we don't care about. We can live with that. Their distinctions, again, turned on this. They looked to scientists like Wallace, and quote scientists like Wallace, who they knew wasn't a Christian, but others, who would say, you haven't gone to explaining these distinctive special characteristics about humans, and that pushes them right into the route of not caring about necessarily the resurrection of the body, but the resurrection of something, soul. And no, there isn't anybody who starts making that other distinction of the body. It seems like that's something we don't, particularly, we're not focused on. Now, Asa Gray wrote his famous essays that went to Yale and gave it those special endowed science and religion lectures at Yale, which were ended up publishing under his theory of theistic evolution. And again, all he focused about is, now he would focus on, and he was a very sort of orthodox Presbyterian, Trinitarian, and he focused on how God would be would be guiding the evolutionary process by guiding the developments of variations over time. So he could have opened the way to thinking about the body, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't make that leap. So it's an interesting point that doesn't become an issue, and what they focus on is the soul and whether humans have a soul or don't have a soul. But the issues you're raising would deal with the current continued issue, because today that's the issue that's being pushed forward, is can evolution, naturalistic evolution, account for the human soul, or is neurobiology going to take away anything, or is neurobiology going to, latest developments in that, going to be able to explain finally the human mental processes and higher processes by purely naturalistic means? So it remains a key issue, and it wasn't one they just spent. Wish I could give an example, but there isn't. Questions? More questions?
Though what you say is true, that there isn't a fundamental difference between Dawkins and Darwin in some ways, there may be certainly a perceived difference in the continuing success of the whole scientific enterprise in explaining things. Now, whether it's actually got to the stage of explaining, as you say, neurobiologically, how this could happen. Dawkins is doing more than just writing the same thing. I mean, he's pulling evolutionary material into his writings. And so my question is, Where does one go here with this? Because it's becoming incredibly complex. I mean, one of the things that it seems to me is that, and my partner, my colleague here and I were just talking about this, that big theories take hundreds of years to develop and understand and the science to back them. So in some senses, this argument is just going to go on for a long, long time. And if ever one could prove this scientifically, it's not going to happen for a long time. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts about are about that, because we're really dealing with a very big and long process. As you look at the other things that have been discovered about the universe and so forth, how long it has taken people to accept the concepts that they now do accept.
It is a long process. And Darwin's Descent of Man is really an amazing book. Origin of Species is as he calls it, one long argument, and is a very persuasive argument for common descent. And a pretty solid argument for natural selection being the main vehicle for common descent. Descent of Man is very different. The Descent of Man is just, if I'd call Origin of Species like the front parlor of a proper Victorian parlor, everything was in place, everything was covered. The Descent of Man is almost like the attic, and it has all sorts of speculations. But it is remarkable how it raises all of the issues without understanding genes, without having any concept of genes. It raises all the issues and plays with all the issues that sociobiology has raised, evolutionary psychology. All the questions come out of different things. He throws out these ideas, some of them fairly half-baked, but very pregnant. So in that sense, no, I don't think that Dawkins, on one sense, has... Darwin was so... had so much foresight in the issues he raised. Now, the person behind Dawkins is more a public science writer, in my opinion. You have to get back to Bill Hamilton and to Ed Wilson, and others who have done, and you could name several more of that category, that have done sort of the hardcore science. And Dawkins mostly just writes it up in ways that will make some people furious and other people exhilarated. And he certainly can add the genetic material. I actually think the more interesting material, while certainly the idea of the selfish gene concept that Hamilton worked out is very, very powerful and very interesting, it's the work on neurology that really Dawkins is not the main popularizer of, that is adding quite a bit to the debate. And I think that is going to keep people thinking. But you've got scientists of equal stature who are then coming back and says, no, you haven't really explained this. This remains an open question. So in many ways, the situation isn't much different than when it was after Descent of Man. Descent of Man got the issues out. They're still out. There certainly has been more evidence that you can accumulate. But have you actually moved to a level such as happened with Origin of Species? People have been talking about common descent in a very sophisticated way for 50 years, before, 70 years before Origin of Species. And Origin of Species basically settled it. After Origin of Species, scientists all over Canada, United States, France, England, they converted within 10 years to common descent. But this other issue remained open. Darwin plays with it, and people continue to play with it. And I certainly agree with you that the issue will remain, will not be settled soon. But what, as a historian, I would say is many of the people, and I tried to say with my presentation, many of the people are bringing other issues to the table. And they're reaching their conclusion on both sides, on every side, based partly on the science, but partly on their interpretation of the science, based on their own, to use a broad term, social concerns they bring to it, because it remains such an open question. Now, again, that even if resolved, you go back to your point, doesn't necessarily, you know, it deals with the Greek sort of version that floats into early Christianity and some of the issues that brought out, but still, it doesn't necessarily go to the deeper issues of marriage. So I agree with you. It's long. There are the big developments since Darwin's time are selfish gene theory, the idea of genes and how genes might be able to explain altruistic behavior. Though many speculators come up and says, no, it still wouldn't work. Hamilton's issues are not a slam dunk. They're only a slam dunk if you want to believe that way. And the latest work in neurobiology. And those things are the really only to add things. But they haven't settled the issue. And I'm talking about people who are not, we're not talking about creationists here. We're talking about people who are trying to grapple with it at the deepest levels. And I agree with you. It'll be a long time before it's settled, if ever. Are there more questions?
Maybe I can ask you one from a different angle. I'm just curious that Origin of Species has been out for, 150 years? We've effectively taught evolutionary thinking for 80 years, 90 years, 100 years plus. And yet I saw during the height of the intelligent design debate, 3-4 weeks ago, two separate polls on CNN, both came out with 88%. 12% basically people saying God had nothing to do with it. 88% to some degree God is fully involved. Yeah. Part of God. I wonder if after, obviously this whole evolutionary thing has had a huge impact on Christianity, on the church. And I wonder if this lack of acceptance of it after 100 years of teaching it, largely atheistic science, is having any impact on science.
No, I don't think it's. The polls are consistent in the United States that about half, somewhere between half to 60% of people accept evolution, and 40% to 50% believe humans were created directly by God. All kinds were created directly by God in the last 10,000 years. And then you go to that 60 to 50% that believe in evolution, and two-thirds of them believe that God was involved in the process. You can take similar polls of scientists, though. And I've conducted some of them, one that was published in Nature. And they'll show that 40% of the scientists believe, virtually all the scientists, or at least all biologists except common descent, I mean, you can't statistically find the people that don't, and you can pretty well identify them. And even some of the, I mean, Michael Behe, the lead intelligent design person, believes in common descent. But that about 40% of the scientists in America believe that God was somehow involved in the process, and about 60% believe that God was not involved in the process. So you get a large group of scientists. But those people who believe that God was involved in the process would include people like Francis Collins, who are, you know, doing some of the most important, you know, cutting-edge science in the biological sciences. They still believe in common descent, but they believe that God was somehow involved in the, they would call themselves theistic evolutionists. And they don't think that God can explain higher, that evolution can explain higher human attributes, but they also think God set the original boundary, somehow created the original rules that led to the evolution. Now, of course, you have scientists who argue just the other way, with using that the the sense that everything's finely tuned for human life could come about naturalistically, and there are writers that go back and forth. But those remain, I would think it would be fair to describe all those as hypotheses at best, not as theories that speculate back and forth. And I don't think those types of debates have in any way inhibited science. I think, indeed, they have probably, as a historian, I would say, many people have been inspired, you know, this is sort of anecdotal because I don't have a poll, but many scientists have been inspired to go into science because they were interested in those big questions. Francis Collins, Charles Darwin, would be examples. E.O. Wilson would be an example. Bill Hamilton would be a clear example. You can see it. Fisher, Haldane, Dobzhansky. You can just rattle off the names where if you look at them and their background, they ended up doing some of the most important biology of the 20th century. The reason why they originally got into was they were interested in these very questions of, do we need God to be involved in the process? Some of them wanting, interested and predisposed to the answer be yes. And some, like David Lack, or, well, David Lack not when he got involved. That wouldn't be fair for him. But Dobzhansky it would be fair for. Fisher it would be fair for. David Lack, Francis Collins. Or the answer is no, and I want to use this to disprove God. And that would be true with Dawkins. That would be true with Ed Wilson. They were thinking about these things at the beginning, and that inspired them. And then like good scientists, and you go back in time, and Newton and Kepler, and you can rattle off the names of people who were like this. Then they, as good scientists, they then did good science. And they, in doing their good science, they came up with important scientific ideas and concepts and discoveries and theories. And then everybody then uses them. The fact that Kepler was motivated for religious reasons doesn't stop the rankest secularist from readily using the three planetary laws, or that Faraday was, or James Clerk Maxwell, or Lord Kelvin were motivated by religious purpose. From then they do it. Sure, they were looking for something. It helped motivate them to get into science. And I think that the tension of this debate motivates both sides. So I think as long as it's at the level of science, not at the level of people just trying to dumb down or promote religion in high schools or something. But as long as we're talking about science, do I think that it slows down science? No. I think that actually from polling a lot of these people and studying these people, I think it inspires their science and keep staying at the cutting edge. Jim Watson in America, Francis Crick, you can find this in all these people. And they are interested in these questions, and it helps inspire them and drive their work. And it doesn't in any way preclude them, whichever side they're on with their predispositions, from actually doing very important science that gets worked into the corpus or into the main body of scientific work. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Would Darwin have been interested in distinguishing the question of the origin of the species from the origin of life? Would he have considered the second question as not necessarily dealt with by the answer of the first?
Yes, is the answer to the question. Next question, no. Yes, most emphatically. He separated out... When he decided that species evolved from other species, 1837, he spent 22 years before he published Origin of Species. And the reason he spent so long was he knew it was controversial, and he was clearly thinking about the different issues involved. And one issue was the origin of species. That's what he calls his book. Another question is the origin of life. And another question is humans. And another, a sub-question of that, is humans' higher attributes. And he very clearly, in his notebooks and in his work, realized these were different questions. And he limited the book Origin of Species because he wanted that to fly. And he wrote in letters to people like Asa Gray, who would question him on these very points. He would tease out in letters saying, no, my main object, my number one object, is to convince people that species evolved from other species. Secondarily, I'd like to convince them that it was done, that was done by a naturalistic process of struggle for survival, natural selection. I'm not looking at all to the origins of life. Now that would make, and if you read Origin of Species, he very clearly says, I'm not dealing with the question of origin of life. Indeed, what my argument shows, and this is pretty close, is that God breathed right, his closing last paragraph, into one form, or maybe four. Four being the, Cuvier had come up with the four basic type life forms. So it might, one or maybe four forms, and from those initial creations, all the other forms, most beautiful and varied, have evolved. And the last word in the book is evolved. That's the only time in the entire book he ever uses the word evolve, or any form of the word evolve. The very last word. Now, so he is clearly saying, I'm not talking about the origin of life, which made Huxley mad. And Huxley would constantly call him on that point. And Huxley was the one who starts pushing the ideas that there could be a spontaneous generation, there could be electricity could cause it, and Huxley speculates about how inorganic could turn into organic. But and he also gets mad at Darwin for not talking about humans. Well, Darwin finally does write Descent of Man and the Emotions of Man, which deals with the human, but he never does the origin of life. So he would have always viewed the origin of life as something, and he writes about it occasionally in his letters. He never takes a public position on the origin of life, and indeed, the position he takes in his published work is, you know, he never repudiates that statement in the last paragraph of Origin of Species, but you do get a sense that he drifts from that. Now, you can follow his own religious beliefs too, and you can follow his own religious beliefs and where he would have been at the time of Origin of Species, and he'd probably be on the borderline between a theist and a deist. You can look through his letters, and he's still writing himself as a theist to some and a deist to others at that time. But he's one or the other at the time of Origin of Species. It's only much later when he calls himself an agnostic. And then only very rarely does he call himself an atheist. You'll find a couple times when he plays with that, but you can tell from the letter that he's just sort of experimenting if he's comfortable with that word, and then he'll quickly retreat to agnostic. But at that time, he'd probably be more in the deist and almost a theist line. But he stays away from origin of life, where Huxley doesn't. Huxley jumps in, and so does Haeckel. They're pushing that. Of course, you get people like Wallace and the people. They're Asa Gray, and they're not in the Origins of Life either. And these are all evolutionists. These are strong evolutionists. Any other questions? He'd call that a hypothesis. He would have always called anything about the origin of life being a hypothesis. He never would have used the term theory on that.
I'll ask you to join me in thanking Professor Larson for an excellent
Thank you all very much.